Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zan. What a sweet intro. I'm honoured.
Well, you should be, but also you're very special and we love hearing from you. You're going to open your gigantic brain for us. So if anybody's confused about the world around them, this is the guy to ask. Let's jump straight into it because Fiona is calling in from Brisbane with a question. Hey, Fiona.
Oh, good morning, morning. Everybody.
Hello.
Good
morning. What's your question?
My question is about blonde hair changing colour. Mm-hmm. I would like to know if things like dyeing your hair can permanently change the colour of your hair and also possibly why blonde hair changes.
I've been reading up on this because it's a bit of a mystery that we still don't fully understand. It turns out that you have melanocytes, M-E-L-A-N-O-C-Y-T-E-S, both in your hair follicle and in your skin. So in your skin, they're arranged, say, one every 100 cells is a melanocyte. It pumps out this black dye and it's involved with making your skin pasty white or jet black or giving you a tan. And also you have very similar cells living in the hair follicle. Now, the hair follicle is an amazing little device. It's already manufacturing hair for you. By the way, you have about 100,000 hair follicles, and each one generates one hair shaft. And even before you get born, they've made an almost transparent, very fine hair, which after you get born turns into a slightly thicker, longer hair, which once you hit puberty, and from puberty till about 25, you have this incredibly full, luxuriant hair growth, almost as good as Russell Brand in his various roles as Aldous Snow, where you are super sexually attractive and evolutionarily, you know, you are hot, you are ready to have children, and then it begins to fade away. Now, these, I've been reading up on these melanocytes, they actually, under stress, migrate. If you look at any political leader, over time, while they're in office, their hair loses colour and they go grey, practically all of them. And what we think is happening, but this has been, because we haven't been able to measure the various presidents and prime ministers and gloriously elected dictators for life, but what happens is that the melanocytes migrate. They actually leave the hair follicle and say, we're going, see you later, mate, and they don't come back and they migrate into the skin. And they can also go the other way, we think, and they can also become more and less active. So the overall pattern through life is that they get less active and you tend to go grey, but under certain stress they can become more active, and if you've got light-coloured hair, they can become darker. And to answer your question of does dyeing your hair make a change, it all depends whether your body, and that includes your skin, sees the dye as a threat.
Right.
Right, so it's a really, really complex situation. I'm just reading this paper at the moment, which is called Aging of Hair Follicle Pigmentation System in the International Journal of Trichology, July 2009. It's a really good summary and it's free.
Where do people find it, Dr. Carl?
Just go to the International Journal of Trichology, T-R-I-C-H-O-L-O-G-Y, and it's called Aging of the Hair Follicle Pigmentation System.
There you go.
And it's not simple, but it's amazing. Whoa.
Thanks for the call, Fiona.
Thank you.
Bye. Sorry to throw you in a deep end, Fiona.
No, I also love that Fiona just has a question about that and you just have a paper on hand.
It's part of the reading.
It's not a setup. It's just there.
It wasn't a setup.
Let's go to Trevor, who's calling in from Toowoomba with a question. Hey, Trevor.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks. What's your question?
Okay, so last night I was reading this book by Judd Apatow about like how he got into his comedy career and TV and everything, and there was a really inspiring bit, and I got this like tingling sensation all over, and you get the same sort of feeling like maybe if you ask somebody out and they say yes, one of those sort of things. I was just wondering what is actually happening in your body when that happens?
Almost certainly the sympathetic nervous system is responding in a very mild reaction. So parasympathetic nervous system is there with relaxing after a meal and your blood vessels increase in size to your tummy so you can relax more. The sympathetic nervous system is to deal with emergencies, and this is not so much an emergency, but it is an unexpected shock to your intellectual system, which then reflects itself in your body. And so what happens is that the blood supply to the skin is closed down, the blood supply to the muscles is increased, the heart rate is increased, the blood flow is increased, and the adrenal glands start dumping adrenaline. And you can feel this sort of tingle. And every now and then when you're reading a book that's really good or you're having an emotional experience, you actually get this full-on body visceral response.
Yeah.
And so you've just had the – so almost certainly it's part of the sympathetic nervous system, but I'm just guessing on that. I'd have to check the peer-reviewed literature, so that's just my guess. Sorry, Trevor.
Thanks for the call, Trevor.
Awesome. Thank you.
Let's head now to Lake's Entrance. Dylan is on the line. Good morning, Dylan. What's your question?
G'day, Dr. Dan, Dr. Carl. I'm just wondering, given the right conditions, could a tree live forever?
It's a funny question, and it seems from what I've been reading that trees – don't actually have a finite lifespan. And while you'll say that the bristlecone pine in California, wherever it is, lives for 5,000 years and other trees live for 50 years or 100 years, under the right conditions, they can keep on living in the sense that the inner core of the tree is dead and the only bit that's living is the bit underneath the bark and then the leaves. And we'd really need to get a arborist, botanist, to talk more about that. But they keep on dropping hints that that the trees in general will die at 100 or 50 years, but they could theoretically live forever. So the answer to that question is a definite maybe, and maybe we should get a botanist person on to answer all tree-like questions.
If there is a botanist or an arborist who's listening, give us a call and help Dylan out. Thanks, Dylan. Keep listening.
Thank you,
Dr. Dylan.
1-300-055-36 is the number to call. If you've got any comments or answers for us, you can text us 0439-757-555. Tracy's calling in with a question from Brizzy. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
We want to know, why are coffee grinds so good for gardens and skin?
Coffee grinds. What's the scientific goodness going on with coffee grinds?
There's all sorts of different chemicals in there, and I'd be willing to bet that what they are giving is a source of nitrogen and phosphorus. So if you go looking at fertilizers, I'm trying to learn about fertilizers at the moment because at the university where I am, the University of Sydney, they can have their playing fields absolutely hammered by a combination of a whole series of soccer competitions followed by bad weather, followed by rain, followed by muddy playing. And then the gardeners go in there and a week later, it's like it was perfect forever. And I can't do that at home. So I'm reading up on it. And so an important part of it is the ratio of carbon and phosphorus and nitrogen. And what you're doing is giving nitrogen. Now, nitrogen is a weird thing. One of the major markers of the what we call the Anthropocene, where we humans influence the planet, was in the early 20th century, where we worked out how to get inert nitrogen out of the atmosphere and turned into fertilizer. And that caused such massive changes to our planet of the like we haven't seen for 2.5 billion years. So nitrogen is the big one. So you've got to get the plants the nitrogen, and the phosphorus helps as well. And that's about the end of my knowledge. I don't know specifically what plants coffee is good for, nor do I know which plants it might be bad for. Like we've got a rose at home.
A single rose?
Well, it's the first rose I ever grew. Somebody gave it to us and we left it in a pot for about 2 months.
That's good. No, I was just asking. I wasn't dissing the single rose. It's exciting.
We left it in a pot and we didn't water it and it nearly died. And then we planted, put in the ground and gave it rose fertilizer. We bought 10 kilograms, which is possibly more than we need for a single rose. And it actually came out with a red bud. It was amazing.
Maybe it needs some coffee grinds. Yeah, it needs a shot of coffee.
And I started reading on the side of the packet and it went through the, well, it's got the carbon nitrogen phosphorus ratio in the 4-3-18, which of course is so much different from what you want from an asparagus. And there's all this implied knowledge, and I suddenly realised I was entering a field that I knew nothing about.
Tracy, we'll see if we can find out exactly why they're so good, other than what Dr. Carla said, but hopefully that helps you out a little bit on your way. Thanks for the call.
Hopefully everyone will just start hurling coffee grinds all over sporting field.
We'll see. Going to continue in the coffee theme for a little while longer because Danielle from Maitland has called in with a question. Hey, Danielle.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Carl. Hi, Dan. How are you going?
Very well. What's your question about coffee?
Good. I want to know why certain cheaper coffees make me sweat and increase my body odour.
Actually make you sweat more.
Yeah.
Right.
Ah. Okay. But not all coffees?
Not all coffee, no.
Okay.
So it seems as though it's perhaps a certain bean, maybe?
Mm. The way, is this percolated coffee or espresso coffee or instant coffee?
Espresso.
Wow. Okay. I've been trying to learn about coffee and having single origin coffees all over the place, and I don't understand why they're slightly less bitter than blended coffees. I would have thought it'd be the other way around, but that doesn't make sense to me. So almost certainly what's happening is that there is a chemical, which is a really dumb and obvious thing to say, in the coffee bean that has made it into the coffee bean powder and it's been ground up, that sets off a sweating reaction. I get sweating reactions only with mainly chili-type foods. You're getting it with a coffee. If you actually look at what's in coffee, there are a whole bunch of chemicals, some of which have the interesting names of putrescine, which literally, if you isolate that, it sounds really putrid. Cadaverine, which is a chemical given off from dead bodies, and a whole bunch of other nasty-smelling chemicals that when you put them together, smell and taste nice for some people. So there's some sort of reaction going on there, which is a really dumb thing to say on my part, that you're reacting to something in one of the coffees but not the other, and I don't know what it is.
Okay, so maybe... So that's all right. So maybe some of the coffees have those chemicals and perhaps others don't.
That's right, because the if you try the single origin coffees, which come from a little farm in Kenya, New Guinea or wherever, they're amazingly different week to week. As they get, they try the different individual coffees.
Aye, of course.
Yeah, but the whole thing with you buy a certain brand of coffee, their main goal is consistency, and they will mix them in such a way as to always taste the same. So if there is something in there that causes a sweating reaction, probably it's diluted way, way down in a mix and you don't get it.
Hey, thanks for the call, Danielle.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
It's interesting too, I was having a chat with someone about champagne, as in the legit champagne, which you can only call champagne from Champagne in France.
Mm-hmm.
And the big producers of champagne have to make it always taste the same as well. So you think about that as an organic process in terms of using fruit that has different flavor profiles every year, but you have to make sure that you're creating the same end result out of that every year, which is kind of crazy, isn't it?
It's very difficult chemistry. I've been into champagne, and my new best friend forever, Gerard Ligier-Belair, who is the chief chemist for Moët and Chandon, and notice I said Moët, not Moët,
yes,
because they're Belgian, and so you pronounce the T. And you go underground, and there are 20 million bottles that they've got down there, as all sorts of references, and France is heating up with global warming, and they've passed a law that allows them to source some of their grapes from overseas, and all the French vineyards in Epernay in Champagne are buying up in Tasmania.
Wow.
And they're going to, because, and already people in Victoria who grow wines and et cetera, grapes, they're shifting to Tasmania with global warming because the warming boundaries are shifting from the equator to the poles at 5 kilometres a year, 50 kilometres a decade, 500 kilometres a century. And so the result with, for example, wheat has been that in Western Australia, wheat yields reached their maximum in 1990. And since then, the rainfall's gone down by 28% in Western Australia and the temperature's gone up by 1%. And I've been over there and talked to the wheat farmers. There's been a massive decrease in government science for coming up with new breeds of wheat, and so they've just plateaued since 1990.
It's happening all around us, isn't it? 1-300-055-36 is the number. Dr. Carl is with us. We're talking science with you. And Darren's calling in with a question. Thanks so much for waiting on the line, Darren. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Hi, doctors, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
So I was in a paddock in New Zealand for a party a few weeks ago, and I was with my missus, and, you know, it was quite the romantic scene, you know, mountains everywhere, and she touched the fence and we were touching of sorts, and I just wanted to know why I got shocked a lot more than she did. Like, it really hurt me, but I didn't hurt her.
Ah, okay, so there's an electric fence with, say, 10,000 volts at high voltage but low current. Who was the human that first touched the electric fence?
That was my girlfriend.
Okay, so she touched the fence and then you were holding hands, and so it went through her to you, and then you touched the ground.
Well, we weren't really holding hands, but, you know, we were
There was something touching.
Okay, right.
Use your imagination.
Okay, now, look, now, Darren, look, now you might think that you, as a human, are the peak of evolution on planet Earth, magnificent in facility of mind and bodily movement, and yet, from a physiological point of view, you're just a bag of salt water. And so is your girlfriend. And so the voltage goes through her, and she's a pretty good conductor. So you've got 10,000 volts going into her, and it goes through her body, very low current, so it doesn't mimic the current in the heart. If it's too high a current, you get burnt. If it's too low, you get a tingle. If it's exactly the right current, you die. So they've juggled it so you get a tingle, but you don't get burnt, and you don't die. So it goes into her body, we'll pick a number, 10,000 volts, and it comes out, because she's such a good conductor of electricity, at 9,000. You pick it up from her at 9,000 volts, and then you're touching the ground at zero. So there's a bigger voltage drop through you, so you get the bigger shock. You're at the end of the chain. Now, that's one explanation, and people might disagree with that.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Darren.
Thank you, Dr. Darren.
See you later. Let's go to Gary calling in from Toowoomba. Hey, Gary, what's your question?
Hey, guys, how you doing?
Good. Thanks.
That's the way. My question, I go camping a lot, and people always say, oh, I add salt to the ice in my esky, and it lasts longer. I get another day or two out of the ice before it melts. Now, it doesn't make sense to me, like on a chemical point of view. If I've got two eskies, and I take two bags of the same ice out of the same freezer and put one in each esky and keep them in the same conditions, but one esky I add salt to, they're sort of saying that esky with the salt is going to last for maybe 5 days, and the one without the salt will only last for 4 days. Does that make sense from a physical point of view?
It does. It's a complicated thing. So the last time I was in the Antarctic, I jumped into the Southern Ocean in the Ross Sea with Mount Erebus smoking away happily 4 kilometres high behind us, and the temperature was minus 1.8.
Mm-hmm.
Not zero, minus 1.8. So if you get pure water, and the water out of the tap is pretty pure, and you try to freeze it, as you get colder and colder, you'll get it starting to freeze at zero. Add a bit of salt to it, it'll go to minus 1.8 in the ocean. And if you add more and more salt, it'll go to minus 5, minus 10 before it freezes.
Mm.
And in fact, in the center of each of the icebergs is a pool of ultra-salty water that has not frozen. And when that iceberg, because as the ice melts in an iceberg, just doing a diversion here, as the ice melts in an iceberg, there's this freezing front that pushes all the impurities ahead of it. So the ice itself is pure H2O, and the salt is in a little packet. And when that iceberg breaks loose and then melts, that ice, which is super cold, maybe minus 10, minus 15, and super dense, it falls to the ocean floor, and then pushed by other water behind it, now we're talking Antarctica, travels on the ocean floor up the east coast of Australia, across the equator, and ends up in Japan. Isn't that amazing?
It is, yeah.
Getting back to your problem here, so the ice in the freezer is minus 18. You chuck some water at it, and you sit the temperature of the water will be zero. But if you throw a bunch of salt in there, it can go to minus 1, minus 2, minus 5, minus 10. And what you're trying to do is achieve the maximum amount of, new word, coolth, C-O-O-L-T-H. And so if your beloved beer, milk for coffee, whatever, is at minus 15, it'll survive longer than if it's at zero. You're providing a greater temperature difference between it and the environment.
Thanks for the call, Gary.
All right, okay, but you're not really changing the temperature. It still comes out of the freezer at minus 18.
But the water goes to minus 10 instead of zero.
Yeah, so it changes the melting point.
You change the melting point. Look, I do not understand this fully. I just suddenly realised I don't understand the interstitial ice properties of the sodium chloride, and I'm going to have to do a story on this in a few weeks and read up on it in the same way that I read up on melanocytes in hair.
Gary,
keep listening to Great Moments
of Science. Dr. Carl will do some work for you. We'll hopefully check
sounds
in with
great.
That soon.
Yeah, I need to understand this deeply, Gary.
We love it when people give you homework, Dr.
Thanks,
Carl.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Dr. Gary. Thank you
Let's go for a quick question from Georgia, calling
Georgia.
In from Croydon. Hi, Georgia.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I just want to know the evolutionary reason behind crying and why. Why that emotion, that response happens.
Okay. The traditional response in the media and among the agony aunts is that it helps you get it all out of your system and it releases all the hormones and you feel better. However, in real life, in most situations, crying shows you at your most vulnerable, where you're also physically vulnerable. If your eyes clouded with tears, you can't fight the killer tiger or the forces of supernatural undead.
How does that help you evolutionary, though?
It doesn't.
Evolutionally.
There's only one circumstance in which crying actually helps you, and that's where you and another person or persons, a small group, are together in a group and they're with you privately from the outside world. And under those circumstances, when their goal is to help you get through it, it is better for you. So according to the evolutionary biologists, we still don't understand why we cry, because in the majority of situations, you're just out in public and you're at a disadvantage. Mm. It's a mystery.
There you go. It's a mystery of science. Thanks for the call, Georgia.
Thanks so much, Ben. Thanks, Dr.
Carl. Oh, Ryan, you've been waiting so long on the phone. Thank you for waiting.
Yeah, no worries.
Calling in from Brisbane, what's your question?
Okay, if I'm viewing myself or a reflection of myself in a mirror from a distance of 1 metre, am I seeing myself from the distance of a metre or am I seeing myself from 2 metres?
2 metres. All a mirror does is shift your viewing point in space, so you are on the other side of that mirror 1 metre away looking at yourself. So the total distance is 2 metres. And if you get a camera, usually it'd have to be a single lens reflex with a distance scale on the lens, you can then focus and see that the distance to the image is in fact 2 metres, not 1 metre.
Okay, cool. Right, thanks,
thanks for the call,
Ryan.
Let's go to Noosa. Cam's on the line. Hey, Cam.
Hi, Dr. Cam. Welcome.
Good morning, Dr. Carl, Dr. Zan.
Morning. What's your question?
I got a question. You might get this pretty regularly, and Dr. Zan might not relate too much to you, but more myself and Dr. Carl. But Dr. Carl, when I wake up in the morning, I have a pirate plank to deal with. And if I'm lucky, I guess I, you know, if I have a babe with me or something like that, I get to walk the pirate plank with him. However, other times...
Cam, are you talking about a morning erection?
Yes.
Cool. What's
Continue.
Your question?
Yep.
Well, other times I don't have a morning erection. And, I sort of, you know... get horny, and then my wondering is, does the mind control the body or does the body control the mind?
We got there.
Ah.
I think Cam was trying to be a bit poetic. It is science hour. We can talk plainly. Mm. We can speak directly. Does the mind control the body or the body control the mind?
Both ways. It's well known in horse training and breaking a horse that before a horse is about to rear or get really angry, it will prick up its ears. So its ears form a really strong little pyramid. And it's well known among horse trainers that if you tape down the ears with a bit of tape, not being able to show that it's angry by popping its ears up, actually makes the horse just a little bit amenable. So the body can influence the mind and vice versa. It goes in both directions.
Thanks for the call, Cam.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Matt in Melbourne. Hey, Matt.
Matt, welcome. Good morning.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
Okay, so I go to the supermarket, I buy chicken, and I prepare it. I put it in individual Glad-wrapped or zip-sealed Glad bags and put it in the freezer, take all the air out of it, and then when I want to eat it or prepare it for food, I take it out and defrost it and put it on a plate. So when I do that, when I go to collect the plate, all the chicken juice has managed to somehow get on the outside of the bag, and it's completely airtight. So I was wondering, how is that possible?
I've asked the physical chemists about this, and it's surprising that it happens with Ziploc bags. Cough, cough, cough.
It's all right, Dr. Carl, just take a sip of water. Mm-hmm. It's all good. Doing a lot of talking.
And... in general, it happens with ultra-cheapo bags, and I'm a little bit surprised that it's happening with the slightly higher quality bags that have a Ziploc. Now, at one end extreme, you've got glass, which is a smooth, impervious membrane. And if you chuck some liquid inside or some gas inside, it's never getting out, never, 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 even till the age of the universe-ish. Mm-hmm. If you have a high-grade plastic, once again, the same deal. And it turns out that some plastics are actually better at resisting stuff going into them than glass. In fact, when they're – this is a weird thing. Sorry to do a diversion on you, Zan. But when they're catching fart gas, it turns out that fart gas can actually eat its way into glass but not into the high-grade plastics. Normally, when you're getting at the other extreme, El Cheapo plastic bag, it is kind of like, on a molecular level, a bunch of strands of barbed wire. They've just thrown this El Cheapo molecules together and they've got this thing that you put some water in it. Yeah, the water will stay there for a minute, but you leave it there for 5 or 10 minutes or you apply some heat and it will push its way through the individual holes that exist between the barbed wire strands. Now, the Ziploc bags I would have thought would have been a higher grade plastic, but on the other hand, we're not necessarily manufacturing or checking in them here in Australia or checking their quality when they come in. So it could be
well,
I do
buy the cheap ones.
Okay, look, try buying the more expensive ones and let us know what you find.
Okay.
Okay, so probably it won't get through the more expensive ones.
Thanks for the call, Matt.
Cool.
Thank you, Dr. Matt.
Let's go now to Mitch calling in from Melbourne. Good morning, Mitch. What's your question?
Good morning, Zan. Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Hello.
My questions are, it's an environmental question. To alleviate the drought or drought in central Australia and in rural areas, can we extend rivers from the ocean or dig new man-made trenches from the ocean?
We did that with the Snowy Mountain Scheme and changed the path of the river so that it tended to run more inland than out to sea. The disadvantage is that you're changing what was there, which has got its own, you know, ecological balances. The other factor is that the water is in open channels called a river or a canal and can evaporate like crazy. And you want it to be fully sealed so it'll get further where it's going. The problem with Australia is that we do not have massive rivers simply because we don't have massive mountains. Europeans come to Australia and they say, where are your mountains? They just look like rubble. You know, they go to COSI and they say, it's just rubble. And it is compared to what they've got in Europe. If you look at America, they've got mountain chain on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, and you've got, you know, big mountains, you know, kilometres and kilometres high, and you've got rivers running down them. You know, the wind with water vapour runs into them. You get a thing called orographic lift, O-R-O-G-R-A-P-H-I-C, lift, and then the water flows down. We don't have big rivers, so we don't haven't got a big supply of rivers we can do.
Right. So even if we were to artificially dig larger rivers from the ocean, it would still evaporate by the time it would reach the centre of Australia?
Not all of it, but it all depends on how much you do. I have got a book at home, which was written by an engineer, and it's called Man-Made Mountain, and in it he proposes running for 3,000 kilometres along the border of Western Australia and then South Australia and Northern Territory, a 2-kilometre-high mountain, and that would create rain. Minor technical problem of building a 2-kilometre-high mountain.
I was going to say, it probably take a while to build.
Yeah, it's just an engineering problem. Just add money. You can build anything. Just add money.
Interesting question and concept. Thanks for the call, Mitch.
Thank you.
Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
Hello, what's your question?
Is there such a thing as thorium molten salt power generation?
The Americans played with it. It's a nuclear reactor type and it has advantages over the nuclear reactors that we use today. Number one, it cannot go bang, and that's not because of people being good engineers or doing their job, but because of the laws of physics. It cannot go bang because of the laws of physics, number one. Number two, it gets a lot more energy out of the fuel. Normal nuclear waste still has 95% of the energy still in it. In other words, they only use 5% and they throw it away. Whereas with a thorium reactor, instead of getting 35%, you get 30. But they have a disadvantage that it's much harder to make nuclear weapons from them. You can. And for the countries that have nuclear reactors, the backstory is that they want to also get nuclear weapons.
Thanks for the call, Andrew.
Thank you.
Let's go to Harry calling in from Canberra. Good morning, Harry. What's your question?
Look, I've got a fair few mates who reckon that roll-your-own cigarettes are, I guess, less damaging to your body than
the pre-rolled ones. Is there actually any truth behind that?
Zero. It's the exact opposite. I wrote about this in my 36th book. I myself, in my 20s, took up the most dangerous and addictive psychoactive drug known to the human race, tobacco, and I smoked it for a few years, foolishly, because I was under the impression that, like you, that rollies were healthier. Firstly, tobacco causes 89% of all Australian drug-related deaths. Forget ice, tobacco is a big killer, and it kills 11% of all Australians in general. Secondly, the tobacco companies claim that they provide a great tax benefit to Australia. Each year, the cost of tobacco health, the health cost of tobacco, covering everything, is $31 billion. The revenue is $5 or $6 billion from tax. So people smoking cigarettes cost the economy, via the tobacco companies, $25 billion a year. And then thirdly, the stuff in it, in your tailor-made cigarettes, factory-made, the additives make up 0.6% of the weight of the tobacco, less than 1%. In Rolly tobacco, it's 13.
So it's more additives in the Rollies.
20 times more additives, and it's 17% for pipe tobacco, and they include sweeteners such as honey, sugar, dextrose, and a whole bunch of things such as polypropylene, glycol, glycerol, whole bunch of weird chemicals in there to make it taste better. But overall, it is worse for your health than smoking tailor-made or factory-made.
Myth busted, Harry. Take that back to your mates.
There you go. That's some pub ammo.
And all the pub ammo and all the other things as well about how smoking is just terrible for you and for everyone.
And as Dr. Carl said in the fabulous Splendor in the Grass video, watch it on the Triple J site, if you smoke lots of cigarettes, by the time you're 50, you won't be able to have an erection.
It's important to note as well. Thanks for the call, Harry.
No problem.
Thank you.
Let's go to Rosie calling in from Anglesey. Hey, Rosie.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I'm just wondering, with a stress-related migraine, is it possible to talk yourself out of it?
Yes, but the success rate is not very high. There are a few humans who have remarkable control of their bodies. So when I jumped into the Antarctic, I went, and my daughter and everybody else, we went straight into a mini hypothermia, and about an hour and a half later, even though we were only in for 10 seconds, both my daughter and I went into this intense shivering for 20 minutes and we had no control. There are a very small number of people, maybe five that we know of, who can jump into cold water, and by cold I mean Arctic or Antarctic, and not get hypothermia. There's a very tiny number of people who can control their heart rate. So if we knew the pathway and if it was easy enough, you could theoretically do it. But but the success rate is not high. If you want to read more about it, there are articles in the New Scientist about this guy and there's in look up Arctic swimmer.
Yep.
I reckon that would do it in the New Scientist website. And you can read the articles for free and that'll get you started down this pathway. But bear in mind, not the overwhelming majority of us can't do it, but you could be that person who could control yourself.
Okay, awesome.
Good luck, Rosie. Thanks for the call.
Best of luck, Rosie.
Thanks.
Let's go to Bradley calling in from, the Sutherland Shire.
Hi,
Hello,
Bradley.
You're on a bit of a dodgy line. We might actually try and come back to you because that's sounds like it's on a CB radio. I'm going to go instead.
Do people still have CB radios?
Yes. See if Tom's here. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
How are you guys? How are you going?
Calling in from Wollongong. What's your question?
I'll give you a bit of context around the question just quickly. So a couple of days ago, I got caught in floodwater. I made the very stupid decision to drive through and I couldn't get out of the car by myself. Someone had to actually come and rescue me. My question is, why can't you open your car door in deep floodwater?
Because the water weighs a lot. Air weighs 1.25 kilograms per cubic meter.
Yep.
Water weighs 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter. And on the door, on the outside, you'd have 1 meter by 1 meter. And so you've got all this weight of water you're trying to push back. You can't push back 1 ton.
Right. Okay.
So your best bet is to roll down the windows as soon as you're caught in floodwaters and then get out of it. I've only once voluntarily gone into something like a floodwater and I got all the family to get out first.
Yep. I think the main point to take away is that listen to what the authorities say, which is don't drive into floodwaters. It's not worth it.
Oh, no.
I've had the talking to.
Yeah. It's tricky, though, because you walk across it and it goes up to your knees and you think, well, it's pushing a little bit. And so we were trying to cross the Murrumbidgee River. We had this four-wheel drive expedition. We were trying to go from Sydney to Melbourne the long way, following the spine of the Great Dividing Range. And I took this rented... this vehicle I was test driving, and the trouble was that I got all the family out, and then the water lifted the vehicle up and shoved it sideways into a deeper part. Then luckily there was a shallow part, and I've been test driving four-wheel drives for decades in the Australian Outback. Mate, I was never so scared.
Yeah.
Water is very powerful, way more powerful than us, so steer clear of it. I'm glad that you came out of it. Okay, Mitch, thanks for the call. Sorry, not Mitch.
Sorry, Tom.
Tom. Sorry, I'm going to go to Mitch next. But we actually have run out of time, Dr. Carl. So that is about all we have this morning. You can find Dr. Carl's podcast, as I mentioned, later on this afternoon, wherever you find your podcast, it's totally free. Subscribe, and then you don't have to think about it. It just pops into your feed every single week. And we'll see you once again, Dr. Carl, next week talking science.
It'll be ever so pitchy keen.